Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
Thank you. When I sent my proposed topic in for this lecture, for those of you who know Jamie suggested that I do a two-pronged approach, and I'll give you a quick outline of both of them. Whenever I do any defense of Christianity, I use a method that is not the normal or most popular method used by Christian apologists. But before I tell you what this particular method is and how it applies to the New Testament veracity, he asked that I also give you a quick outline of the typical way it's done. So I have kind of a two-tiered approach today. I purposely do not have PowerPoint-type slides because I think it's going to be a little distracting. There's so much material. I'm going to be flipping this thing continually and letting you. I was telling Lane before the deal today, I did a PowerPoint at another school a couple weeks ago, and there are 90-some slides in it. And after a while, you just kind of think everyone's, you know, get distracted by the. Now, you may disagree with me. My youngest son is in college. He came home the other day and he said, "Dad, I got this professor, and all the guy does is stand behind a lectern and talk. He doesn't use any PowerPoint. He hardly even moves." And he says, "I'm sick of professors, so don't do something like that." And I thought to myself, "That's me. That's how I lecture." So I'll try to keep you on your toes. But there's a lot of data to share with you today. But that's a quick outline of what I'd like to do. I'll give you a quick rundown of the traditional way that the New Testament is depicted, and then I'm going to tell you a different path. Now, before I start, let me give you a definition of each of them. The traditional method, I'm going to call a top-down method, or maybe you could say an umbrella method. And by umbrella, I mean you spread your data at the top, and then you have kind of a trickle-down to the next point you want to make. And the argument goes something like this. This is the traditional method. The New Testament is trustworthy, and it's trustworthy on two basic fronts. And I'm going to outline these for you in just a second, so you don't have to try to get these down right away, but to give you the outline before the outline. The first one says, it makes two general moves. The first is to say the New Testament text is virtually identical or close enough to the original that we know what the author said. And that's agreed to by virtually all researchers. That's not really contested. And the second move with the traditional apologetic is to say, we know what the author said, and every time we can check the authors out, what the authors say is reliable. So we have what they said, and what they said is reliable. And for purposes of today, I'm going to use the words reliable and trustworthy as synonyms. In other words, it's a good historical text. What it means to be historical. And then they're going to say, trickling down underneath the umbrella, they're going to say, we know what it says, we know that where we can check it out, it's reliable, and therefore, next step down, we can take the teachings at face value. That's the traditional approach, and I'll give you a quick outline. The one I want to do for you, I call a minimal facts approach. It's based on studies in ancient historiography, and it's the way we do Greco-Roman history and ancient studies of that nature. And it's a piecemeal method. Instead of the umbrella, we know this, so therefore we know this, so therefore we know this, it builds from the bottom up, and it takes blocks, building blocks. And it says, here's some tests for when you have a reliable piece of data. And when you get a lot of reliable pieces of data from these tests, which I'll give you a list of them, when we have a lot of reliable puzzle pieces, let's call them blocks, you can start building the case from the bottom up. Because when you have blocks, you build with them, right? So the first one says, we got this big structure, and we have a trickle down. The second one says, there's some issues with that. And we can discuss some of the issues if you want during the Q&A. But basically, the second approach says, now let's give some critical rules. And these are rules that historians apply to ancient texts, and they are the same rules that critical Bible scholars apply to the text. Not evangelical, non-conservative. They're the same sorts of blocks that the Jesus Seminar uses. How many of you know who the Jesus Seminar is? A lot of you, okay. They're the guys that throw the beads in the hat, and as one European scholar said, only in America would people throw beads in a hat and judge what percentage, make this a democratic process. Only in America do people judge what percentage it is that Jesus spoke certain words. But they reject depending on which level you use, they reject between 80 and 90% of the red letter words in the Gospels. But they accept these building blocks. Everyone accepts the building blocks. That's a pretty much unanimously accepted method. That's the second one I'm going to do for you. Okay? So I'll outline the umbrella approach quickly, as Jamie suggested, just so we get everybody on the same page. And this top-down, this top-heavy kind of approach makes two general moves. The first one says the text is accurate. Not necessarily reliable, just accurate. To give you an analogy, if we know what Homer says in the Iliad, if we have the text, the first thing you want to study, if you're majoring in classics, you want to know that the text you're studying is really what Homer wrote. After all, if you're doing your master's thesis or your dissertation on Homer, you want to know that you have Homer. That doesn't mean Homer's accurate. It doesn't answer the question of whether there was really a Trojan War or a Trojan horse, let's say. Doesn't really answer that question. But it tells you we have what Homer wrote. Then the next step is to say this text is reliable. So first of all, I want the text, and secondly, I want to be able to check the text with the real world. I want to check with data we have. And this, as I suggested, this would be applied to Homer, this would be applied to Plutarch, this would be applied to Livy, or Tacitus, or Suetonius, or Dio Cassius, or any of these. And when a person passes these two tests, we know what the author said, and we know that what the author said is reasonably accurate. We have, it's generally thought at that stage, that we have a good text. That's the way ancient history works. All right, now let me take this first one. Again, this is the traditional method. The so-called umbrella top-down approach. How do we know we have a good New Testament text? Why, for example, do critics really not dispute this point? One theologian said, evangelicals / other conservatives and non-conservatives, there's three steps. This guy was making a pretty good point. He said, everybody says the first step is, do we know what the text says? And both sides say, yes. We have what Paul meant us to have. Do we know what the text says? Yes. Do we know what the text mean? There's some differences of opinion, but broadly speaking, you could have as many differences between a liberal and a liberal as you could between a conservative and a conservative. But generally, we know what a text says, and we know what a text means. The guy went on and said, the big difference is what do you do now? We know what a text says within reason. We know what a text means within reason. But is it authoritative? And conservatives say, if you know what the text says and you know what the text means, it's authoritative. Critics say, we know what the text says and we know what the text means, but Paul's a loser. Now, they don't hardly ever say that. Paul's kind of the darling of the critics today. But there's a lot of agreement at these first few levels. And the stuff I'm going to give you, if somebody was sitting here who was down on the Jesus Seminar end of the study, when I start doing this, they probably just roll their eyes. And they say, why are we spending time on this? I mean, it's just not disputed. And it really isn't. But in the name of doing what I told Jamie I would do, give you a quick overview, I'll tell you why there's really not much dispute about the text. Let me give you a figure here to start with. A British New Testament scholar, said a number of years ago that he said we can be approximately 99.95% sure of the words in the text. Now, that's pretty good. But way back around the turn of the last century, around 1900, Westcott and Hort, two of the best known of the textual scholars, who had at that time about 2,000 Greek manuscripts. Today there's about 5,500 or 5,800 Greek manuscripts, plus there's a lot more Latin manuscripts, thousands of more Latin manuscripts, but just Greek alone, about 5,500. Around the turn of the last century, Westcott and Hort had about 2,000. Now, I won't be able to slow down and do this. Somebody can pursue it during a question if you want. But the more text we have, the better able you are to ascertain what the text says, the more copies you have from a variety of areas. Westcott and Hort had about 2,000, and their figure 100 years ago was that we have 95% of the New Testament text. That was that's a 100-year-old figure. 2,000 manuscripts, and 95% of the text. Today, about 5,500, and the latest figure is 99.95%. How do we get there? Well, let's compare the New Testament to ancient classical manuscripts. Okay, let's begin with that. If I want to know what the text says, I've got to have some good copies because there are going to be variant readings. Let me begin with the bad news. We have so many Greek manuscripts in the neighborhood of 55, maybe more right now, maybe 5,800 Greek manuscripts. We have so many copies that there are just plain a lot of variant readings. There are a lot of variant readings. I'm going to surprise some of you when I say this. And this figure is old. But the last figure I saw a couple decades ago is about 200,000 variant readings in the New Testament text. 200,000 variant readings. You say, oh, 200,000. How are we ever going to get to the bottom of this? How are we ever going to find out what the text says? Well, there's a little epistemic thing here for you philosophers. You know how we know there's 200,000 variant readings? Because you can count them. And when you can count them, you can work on them. See, when you can count them, counting them means you know where they are. How many of you have ever seen the red plastic New Testaments that are put out in Greek that are the chief critical Greek text that you could study in any university? If you can study Greek, you can get this red plastic New Testament. How many of you know what I'm talking about? It's about this size. Some of you do. Does anybody know what is the bottom of every one of those pages? When you open up these Greek New Testaments that Greek students study, whether you're in a private school, state university, wherever, when you're studying the Greek text, about half the page will be the Greek text, and there will be something at the bottom. There will be a line below that line. On every page, there's something there. Does anybody know what that is? Those of you who raise your hand, you know what's at the bottom page? It's called critical apparatus. Every major variant reading is listed at the bottom of the page. So if you know Greek, and you get to be really good at this, the bad news is that there's 200,000 variants. The good news is you can put your finger on them, you know what they say, and you can evaluate them. The 200,000 variations bothers nobody. Everybody knows they're there. They're not usually not aware that there's that many. They bother nobody because you can compare texts, and the New Testament is very, very wealthy in texts. Let me give you some examples. If you have 10 copies or partial copies of ancient historical texts like Tacitus, Pliny, Suetonius, if you have 10, you are doing well. You're doing well. If you have 20, there are only a very, very, very few classical texts with more than 20 copies. Homer's Iliad is an example. There are over 600 copies of Homer's Iliad. That's fantastic. So let's take the number one competitor to the New Testament. Okay? Number one competitor. Final score. Let's make this an athletic context. Final score, 5,500 to 650. First of all, you say, well, for classical text, 650 is fantastic. But don't look now, you just got killed. Well, you say, well, come on, it's not that straight a deal. It's not like a numbers game, like a basketball game. No, really. again, we can pursue this in the Q&A if you want to, but for the most part, more texts make a more accurate reading. I'll tell you how you do that if you're interested.